Hi, my name is Stuart Weems and welcome to the Investopoly podcast. My goal is to share easy to understand, evidence-based, holistic insights to help you master the game of building wealth. And in this episode, I'd like to talk about investment bonds. What are they and are they worthwhile? Investment bonds are often marketed as a really tax-effective way to invest money, particularly if you're investing money on behalf of children. And so in this episode, I wanted to talk about some of the pros and cons of investment bonds, discuss some alternatives, and really talk about why we almost never recommend using investment bonds. So really to sort of jump to the conclusion, if you like, that's the answer, but let's talk about why we arrive at that answer. But before we do that, we should really define what an investment bond is. An investment bond is a financial product that typically combines the features of both life insurance and investments. And they're typically issued by insurance companies. Generation Life is probably the most dominant advertiser or company in the space. If you just Google Generation Life, you can get a sense of the sort of products that they're selling and so forth. And investment bonds typically receive concessional tax treatments, which I'll talk about in a second, and you can nominate a beneficiary that receives the investment that you're making either at a certain age or if you pass away. Now, an investment bond, which is really an insurance bond, is just an ownership structure. Okay, it's much like if you had a family trust or a company or you own something in your personal name. It's not the investment per se, it's just the ownership structure. So many investment bond providers do offer a broad investment menu for you to invest in. So you say, okay, I'm going to get an investment bond, and then you've still got the decision where I'm going to put my money. And many of them offer low-cost index rules-based methodologies, much like I talk about in this podcast, including diversified index funds like the ones provided by Vanguard and so forth. So the investment bond is really just tax-effective structure, if you like. And then how you invest the money is critical, of course, but you can still implement a low-cost rules-based evidence-based strategy using an investment bond. Any earnings that the investment bond generates or the monies generate are just reinvested in the investment bond. So that's an important attribute as well. So as I said, they're often marketed with tax benefits. So let's talk about what those tax benefits are. So any investment income or realized capital gains that the investment bond generates are taxed at a maximum corporate tax rate of 30%. So if your individual tax rate is, say, 47%, the highest marginal tax rate, then you're going to be better off. In fact, the ultimate rate of tax that the investment bond pays could be lower than 30% because some investments have imputation credits. Importantly, any income that is generated by the investments within the investment bond aren't taxed to you personally. So remember, they're just quarantined in this investment bond and they don't impact your personal tax position. If you hold that investment bond for 10 years or longer, you won't be required to pay any capital gains tax on any gains that you've made after that 10-year period. So you make the investment today, that investment generates some income, and it may even generate some realized capital gains as the underlying investment turns over investments. That's taxed at no more than 30% each year. At the end of the 10-year period, if you've then got really a large capital gain in that investment, you can divest of that investment, take the money out of the investment bond, and you're not going to pay any capital gains tax. Now, of course, that sounds pretty attractive, but I'll get to why that might not be as attractive as you might initially think. There's also a what's called 125% rule, which means that you can contribute up to 125% of what you contributed in the previous year without triggering a reset of that 10-year period. So let me give you an example. Let's say this year I make a $1,000 investment in an investment bond. Next year, I contribute $500 into that investment bond. In the third year, contribute another $500, and it doesn't reset my 10-year period. My 10-year period started this year when I made that initial $1,000 contribution. So it means that I can spend up to 125% of $500 invest, I should say, in subsequent years. So it does allow you to make these regular investments. and you can make the regular investments throughout the 10-year period without, as I said, resetting when that 10 years began. It's all a little bit wordy here, but as you can get a sense of the flavour of the tax benefits that these investment bond providers advertise. So, of course, there's going to be some fees. Typically, there's an administration fee that you pay the investment bond provider, and that can range between 0.4 and 0.6 of a percent generally. Now, there's going to be some providers that are outside that range, but generally that's what you're going to pay. Of course, you're going to pay some investment fees as well, depending on how you're investing your money. For example, if you invest in a diversified Vanguard fund, you know, Vanguard's going to charge you some investment fees. But typically, again, and I'm going to look closely at Generation Life as an example here, an example of an investment bond provider. Generally, the investment fees that you pay through the investment bond are the same as if you would pay if you were outside that investment bond. So really, the only cost of using the investment bond is really the administration fee that you pay the provider. So therefore, as investors, we need to decide if we're going to pay them 0.4 to 0.6 of a percent as an admin fee every year, what are our likely taxation savings, and if are they more than what the admin fee we're going to pay? And if they are, then great, we might be better off to use an investment bond. So of course, as an accountant by trade and someone that's analytical, and if you've been listening to this podcast for any length of time, you know I love to dive into the numbers, which is exactly what I've done again for this episode. So I thought about, well, if we invested in the Vanguard High Growth Index Fund, which is a diversified fund that invests in both Australian, international bonds, you know, lots of different asset classes there. The challenge with these bonds is they tend to generate more income and less capital gain, sometimes because a little bit of turnover is in those funds as well. So when we look at the 10 years ending December 2023, so the last calendar year, the Vanguard High Growth Fund generated a total return over that 10-year period of 8.7%, which is not too bad. But that return comprised of just around 6% of income and about 2.7% of capital growth, which isn't great. You actually want, as an investor, more capital growth and less income, obviously, because the taxation treatments are different. In any case, I calculated that if I invested $10,000 10 years ago, so January 14, in the investment bond and withdrew it in January 2024, so this year, so just after the 10 years had elapsed, then over that period of time, I would have paid $1,790 in tax, so about $1,800 in tax. My investment would be worth $19,200 after already subtracting the admin fee. So I've gone $10,000, it's now worth $19,200. By comparison, if I made the same investment in the same funds at the same time in my personal name, and if I was paying the highest marginal tax rate, then I would have paid about $4,000 in tax. And as a result, my investment would be worth $17,500. So about $1,700 less, or about 9% lower than the investment bond perspective. And that's even after accounting for the admin fee that I paid for the investment bond provider. So just on that analysis alone, if you're on the highest marginal tax rate, an investment bond could help you save tax, more tax than what it will cost you in administration fees. Again, if you're on the highest marginal tax rate, that's true. If you're on a lower tax rate, that might not always be true. So having said that, it's always important to consider alternatives, because what else can you do with that money as opposed to put it in an investment bond, whether that money is yours and you're saving for retirement, or whether that money is your children's money and they're not 18 yet and you're looking for somewhere, you know, to invest it and do something with it. So the first thing I would say is, once you do have a long-term investment strategy, it's a lot easier to make these decisions with context, right? So if I know what my client's investment strategy is, and then they say, oh, I've got $10,000 that I want to invest for my child, how do I do that? In the context of that strategy, I can give them some really good advice, because I know what else we're doing investment-wise. Now, if I'm just going to look at that question in isolation, it can be more difficult to answer, or at least more difficult to be completely convinced that you've arrived at the right conclusion because you don't really know what you don't know. So I just wanted to throw that out there first and foremost, that as part of a long-term strategy, these questions should be answered. But let's look at some alternatives. So one of the alternatives could be to direct those monies into your home loan. So sometimes people come to us and say, look, this is one of my investment goals. How do I achieve this investment goal? For example, I want to send my kids to secondary private school. They were only born last year, so I'm going to contribute, you know, $2,000 a year into this investment bond. You don't necessarily need to segregate money for a particular goal. And in fact, you could be better off to take a different approach. So for example, by directing as much cash into your home loan as soon as possible, as I talked about last week in the podcast, you know, it provides massive compounding savings. And those savings are guaranteed, whereas investment returns are not guaranteed, of course. And those savings, particularly if it's a home loan, are after-tax savings as well, which is incredibly valuable. So for a client, we might say, okay, you know what? Don't worry about saving for your kids' education at this stage. Over the next few years, just really focus on repaying your home loan. And if you do that, we project by the time you get to school-age children, secondary-age children, you'll have enough cash flow to fund it from your general income because you've spent so much time repaying your home loan as aggressively as possible. So maybe the answer is in a wider strategy. Another option could be investing in your spouse's name if they have a much lower taxable income than you. So the numbers I did were on assuming that the individual was paying 47%, so earning over $200,000 or soon to be $190,000 a year. But if your spouse earns a lot less than that, is on a much lower tax rate, then maybe the admin fees in the investment bond aren't worth paying. Thirdly, it's important to think about what capital gains will you pay, because obviously you've got some savings along the way in terms of capping the tax rate at 30%, which may or may not save you money. It depends on what your personal tax rate is. And you could invest in a company if you wanted to and still cap your tax rate at 30%. But the main attraction is no capital gains tax at the end of the 10-year period, which might sound initially really attractive, but it's important to consider, will you be selling down your investments substantially and triggering a lot of capital gains tax? And when will you be selling your investments down? Will it be while you're working? Or in fact, will you wait until retirement, at which time your only income or your main income source is from a super pension, which is not taxable? Therefore, if you sell $20,000 of capital gain each year from your portfolio, you're still not going to pay any tax. So really thinking critically about capital gains tax liabilities and how they might eventuate. Now, it's difficult to forecast how they might eventuate if you don't really have a long-term plan. But again, for those clients of mine where we've got a bit of a plan, the plan might not actually include selling down any investments at any time, in which case then it puts the potential savings that investment bond provides in context. And the context is we don't need those tax savings, or at least at this stage, we think it's less likely that we'll need those tax savings. The fourth option could be to consolidate investments with your investments. So quite often for clients, we might be investing regularly for them on a monthly basis, and they might then have some money for their kids. So one way to deal with that is to invest that in the same way that we invest their own monies. Or if it's for a goal like private education or a gift or help into property later on, again, we can amalgamate those monies with their regular investing. And if they're doing that via a family trust, because that's what's most appropriate for them, we can leverage that ownership structure by including the kids' savings also in that family trust, thereby allowing you to also try and minimize the tax liabilities in the future as well. And the final alternative to an investment bond is actually to create an account in the child's name. So again, this is appropriate if we're saving or trying to invest on behalf of children. Most share trading, online share trading platforms allow accounts in minors' names, and they essentially function as an informal trust account. So you as the trustee has to make the application, but it's in their name. If you anticipate the child's investment income will be below $416 a year, then all you need to do is apply for a tax file number in their name. And when you open that account, give that tax file number to the provider. So if it's a ComSec account or so forth, use that TFN. So it depends on what you're investing in, of course, but to earn less than $416 a year, your investment balance needs to be $6,000 to $7,000 or less, just roughly, but you need to sort of work it out yourself because it does depend on what you're investing in. If the investment return is likely to be, or investment income is likely to be greater than $416 a year, then you're better off to actually give your tax file number when you set up the account, which means you'll be taxed on the earnings, but that's going to be lower than the miners' rates anyway. And when your child turns 18, you can transfer the holdings into their account. And because it's held on trust, there's no capital gains tax. And therefore, when they're 18, they can take over those investments and then sell them if they want to, you know, go buy a car or whatever it is they're going to use those funds for. And when they do that, maybe if they're at uni or don't have a large taxable income, they're not going to pay very much capital gains tax. But again, still a simpler and lower cost way to invest on behalf of children without needing to pay administration fees to an investment bond provider. So to sort of sum up, while investment bonds do have some good advantages and there are some really unique tax advantages for them, we don't often recommend them. We often find that there's a better way for clients to invest these monies that are going to avoid the administration fees and still provide the same benefits. And of course, those decisions are much easier to make with the context of a longer-term investment strategy. As always, thanks for listening. If you like this episode, please share it with anyone that also might enjoy it or leave a rating. And as always, I have a book discount code in the show notes where you can buy a copy of one of my books for $15, including postage. And until next week, bye for now.